Welcome back. The program is Force and Feeling. I'm your host, Julie Motz, and my guest today is Dr. Martha Eddy, a somatic movement therapist. And we were talking about her work getting a part of the body that is healthy or doing something well to teach a part of the body that might not be doing it so well, how to do it in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, you were just speaking to the notion of finding the tissues that are working well, and in particular with the nervous system, if there's a kind of vitality going on, a kind of clear conducting of nervous system messages through, then we all know about neuroplasticity. More will open up. So that's such a direct conduit for not just learning, but healing. With the other types of tissue, similar things can go on, where if there's a place in the body, for instance, where the ligamentous support around a joint is very clear, and if we can tune into that clarity, it can remind the rest of the body that that tissue exists throughout the body.
Mm-hmm.
Same idea is worked with a lot with fascia in the various myofascial release and rolfing type systems.
And if you could just be kind enough to tell us what fascia are.
Well, we're talking about connective tissue in the case of fascia. Fascia is what is metaphorically the saran wrap around each of the muscles, so it helps to differentiate the muscles. On the other hand, and I love this image, if you take a stack of sandwiches all each wrapped in their plastic baggie to the beach, and you just let them sit out there in the sun, after a while they may all become stuck together. And so we need some movement, some activity to separate out the different muscles where the fascia has gotten undifferentiated, gluey, gooey. So movement and touch can really help with that as well.
So suppose you have a situation where somebody either has, you know, bursitis or some kind of stiffness, and you either through movement or touch or their increased awareness of the tissue vitality, you get them to restore health to the area. What can you do to guarantee that they don't do whatever it was that caused the problem in the first place all over again?
Very important. It kind of brings us to one of the things I would like to talk about, too, which is the relationship of energy work to movement work. My own feeling is that the awareness piece is that real key element for embodied change that can stay with a person. I believe it's Feldenkrais that talks about the pleasure principle the most clearly and says if it really feels good to the body, it will stick around. Which is a nice thought, especially in our puritanical American culture. In Europe, I think this is much more acceptable. But the notion that I'm getting at here is that when we become aware through something as concrete as the physical body and movement of a choice that we have, and if the choice is then working well for us, and there's still no, and this is important, other kind of demons underneath that that are unresolved, then we can simply make the change. And then if we start to slip away from it, then we actually will notice it again. We'll say, oh, I'm hurting. What did I learn at that last session? Ah, right, my neck can relax back. I don't have to work as hard. I can activate my my bony structure and release the musculature. I can feel the support of my lungs. So these are lessons learned that are actually brought to, again, cortical consciousness with words, with discussion, with homework, such that we can retrieve them pretty easily if we choose to.
Well, my question is exactly about those demons underneath, because we all know people who do things that seem to be harming their body, that don't seem they could possibly be giving any physical pleasure. But it seems as if there's some terror of something greater that says, you know, to hell with pleasure, I need to do this to protect myself, and I'm going to do it no matter what.
Well, I can't say that this comes as much from my somatic background as my experience in the world of dance, actually, and in the world of dance therapy. I taught on the faculty of dance therapy departments for 8 years and really value the models of simply acknowledging what is, and truly in the work that hits upon destructive behaviors, to acknowledge, just as is very much accepted in somatic psychology, that there's a need to recognize those as important defenses. and then to really live those out, face them either through witnessing or through exaggeration. And again, that can be through movement, through some kind of touch intervention and movement, through sound and vibration, that somehow gives voice to the very expression that appears, that many people would think, oh, you should just get rid of it. We're saying, no, no. And I think much like you do, let's get into it, let's talk to it, let's work with it, and then find out what else is going on there. And in this model, the somatic model that I work with, we would also find out what would support it. What does it need to feel like the job it's doing is taken care of in some other way?
So in essence, your work would then allow people, you know, again, through movement, through touch, through vocalization, to see what it is the body's responding to, rather than just say, oh, I'm doing this self-destructive thing, or it's just, you know, to actually to make that. And when I say see, I also mean see and feel on a visceral level what it's responding to, so you can understand how to propose a different solution. You can't possibly propose a solution if you don't know what problem the activity is trying to solve.
Exactly. This is the creative work of this work. It's why I love it so much. We never know what the investigation is going to be. We go in with another person, and they begin to speak or feel or talk or moan or simply ask for relaxation, and then from there we just go on a journey together. And if we do hit a point of trauma, or if someone has come in with something that's more identified as a traumatic experience or a frustrating experience, then we may either use talking to identify any points of history or habitual behaviors that will be key markers, and then along with that we'll also work with, for instance, taking a body posture that seems somewhat representative of the feeling, or if I happen to notice someone making a gesture as they're telling their story, we might exaggerate that gesture and see what emotion comes up with the gesture. So working from this kind of nonverbal communication mode, we can go deeper and deeper into the body.
You mentioned that your work and, you know, and Bonnie's work also looks at the embryonic roots of tissues, and I assume of the distortions that occur.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you find yourself, when someone, you know, comes to you with an issue, traveling back that far with them?
It's a statistical question in some sense. I'd probably say maybe 3 in 20 people.
Mm-hmm.
We go there pretty early on, and then with others it may come up much later if they're working over some time together, maybe 20 or 30 sessions, then a little piece of at least the in utero history will come up, maybe not embryonic, but fetal, and or the birth history is more likely to come up. That's even more frequent. And because I work with babies and children, then it's something that I actually, when I'm working with children with special needs, I will actually probe a little bit with the parent to get birth history, and then possibly, if I feel drawn to, kind of recreate a birth situation to help work with that period of time.
Kent, do any particular cases come to mind that you could tell us about?
Let's see. There are a few with the babies. And when I say babies, I'm actually being pretty general. I work with children all the way through the teen years. I work with adults with scoliosis as well. And actually, there is one young gentleman right now that I'm working with scoliosis, where he's in his own process very interested in potential embryonic roots to the scoliosis. So we've been doing a little bit there with, in a way, talking to the unconscious and then letting his body respond. And then I work with ligamentous tissue to help support the curvature of the spine. Or we work with compression in a kind of fetal curve position, where I'm pressing on the head and the lower body to really deepen the sense of bony development through the first curve, the fetal curve, mm-hmm. and then the secondary curves of the cervical spine, the neck, and the lumbar spine, the lower back, can begin to develop out of that clarity of bony compression. So this is pretty detailed and technical. I don't know if that's what you want.
No, it's quite fascinating. So yeah. Typically, what might happen in utero that could cause scoliosis later
on?
Well,
this I don't know. I mean, I really, all I can say is that there may have been something in the early template that caused, for instance, the ligaments to be weaker around. There's longitudinal ligaments of the spine that are on the front of the vertebral bodies, on the back of the vertebral bodies, on the back of the opening of the canal. And so if any of those are not, don't have the full integrity of support, it's much easier for the spine to slip into some of its curves. Generally, we think of scoliosis as possibly being caused by imbalances in the organ system, which again, from your perspective in Chinese medicine, could have a link to the emotional life of the person as well. I have not investigated that as fully as I'd like to. It'd be really wonderful to begin to do at least basic surveys of people with scoliosis to look at their adolescent years and see whether there are notable emotional correlates to perhaps the liver, for instance, causing this lateral curve of the spine into the whole right side of the body at the kind of mid-thoracic region, things like that. But there's so much research that needs to be done on all of this, and I don't think it would be very difficult research if we could just get it coordinated.
You know, that actually is exactly my situation. I have curvature of the spine, and I'm 5'5". My brother is 6'2".
Mm-hmm.
When I went back in utero, what I got was a terror of growing too fast, because my mother really didn't want the pregnancy and didn't want to show. She was a teacher. She worked through her eighth month, and I feel that I made this decision that I wasn't going to grow as fast and never reached my full size. And the way, one of the ways to do it was to curve the spine.
That would be. I mean, it's very typical for people to have a kyphosis, a forward and back curvature of the spine when they're tall. We all know that. We call it, you know, stooping over. But it makes sense as well that someone could curve laterally as well.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break and then we'll be right back.
Okay.